A new deal for the future of the Jacksonville Landing. The feds say JEA can't get out of their nuclear deal. And the city makes a new attempt to cure violence. Some of the stories making headlines this week. Good Friday morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect, and I'm Melissa Ross. Thanks for listening. Just ahead, all of the biggest stories of the week with our Friday roundtable. People already calling in, and you can join them. Get on the line now at 549-2937. Then later, all the amazing talents on show this weekend at Douglas Anderson's 32nd annual extravaganza. We'll have a live in studio performance. All of that ahead. But first, it's Friday, and here to discuss a very busy week in the news, we welcome David Bauerlein with the Florida Times Union.
Good morning.
Journalist Claire Goforth is here. Good morning.
Happy Friday.
David Cotton with the Jax Daily Record.
Good morning.
And contributor and Real Talk podcast host, Charles Griggs.
Good morning.
Guys, so good to have you, and I'm glad you're all here because there's a lot to talk about that happened this week. Everything from a new poll that was released earlier this week from UNF on our Jacksonville March city elections, to city leaders embracing a new approach to cure violence in Duval. We'll talk about that too. But our top story this Friday, the big talker from the week, the future of the Jacksonville Landing. Now, after years of butting heads very publicly, on Wednesday, Landing owner Tony Slaman and Mayor Lenny Curry announced they've reached an $18 million agreement that could result in demolishing part or all of the Landing. Now, here are the terms. The city is offering a $15 million buyout of the company's long-term lease, $1.5 million for tenant subleases and other costs, plus $1.5 million to demolish the building itself. If the Landing is torn down, the city says it might put a park in its place. Council member and mayoral candidate Anna Brochet questioned the timing of the deal, saying it took the mayor over 3.5 years and an upcoming election, she says, to strike a sweet deal on the backs of taxpayers and to make peace with Slaman, who's long been a thorn in Lenny Curry's side. Now, the move has also sparked outcry from activists opposed to all of the recent downtown demolitions. The old City Hall annex was recently imploded. The old county courthouse is going to be demolished. And plans are in motion to remove the Hart Bridge ramps that run through the sports complex. So we're going to begin the hour with a closer look at this. And here's our question to callers. What do you think of this deal on the Jacksonville Landing? What do you think of plans to demolish it? Do you agree that's a good idea, or do you oppose all of these downtown demolitions? Give us a call at 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go online and send your emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org and tweets to @MelissaInJax. David Bauerlein, let's begin with you. There's two Davids today. Now, this joint statement from Lenny Curry and Tony Slaman didn't really specify what's going to happen to the Landing, but the presumption is that they want to tear it down.
Right. That seems to be almost certain to happen. But there's really not a clear idea of what's going to happen next. Last year, the mayor put out some rendering showing it could be a park, a riverfront plaza, lots of green space, some footprint for buildings. But when you go there, the idea would be you feel like you're on a riverfront city park. Now, the mayor's office has since said, well, that was an idea, but it's not necessarily what's going to happen. In that way, I suspect there'd be some kind of a mixed use where there'd be, you know, offices, maybe apartments, stores, shops. The big question is, how big is the building's going to be? How much of it's going to be just wide open green space versus, you know, brick and mortar on that site after the demolition is done and there's a new development there?
Let us know what you think should be done with the Landing spot at 549-2937. Charles Griggs, what about the pushback from Urban Core activists? They don't like the idea of existing buildings being torn down. And, you know, this comes on the heels of the City Hall annex being torn down. The old downtown courthouse is coming down. The Hart Bridge ramps are coming down. There's a hue and cry that we need to repurpose these buildings, not demolish them. What do you think about that?
So back in 2014, the DIA looked at Downtown Investment Authority, looked at ways of maybe perhaps enhancing or remodeling the Landing area. And they came up, you know, they were holding community meetings at how to repurpose the area and so forth. But, you know, you got to think about, you know, what could you actually do down there that would be really a draw to downtown Jacksonville. You want this to be the jewel of the community, you know, the urban core along the river. And it almost seemed like starting from scratch is not a bad idea, given all of the things that has been done down there before. And really, to be honest, I think the most remarkable thing about this entire deal is the fact that less than a month ago, there was so much vitriol between the two parties.
Exactly.
Right? And now, it, you know, it's everybody is, you know, it's a big love fest, you know, in the name of progress. I think that what people probably are more concerned about is what this means to the actual riverfront itself. You know, what type of input they can have and how that's going to come along versus maybe perhaps deals being done in the back room and people not having an opportunity to feel like they participated in the process.
Right. David Cotton, as Charles said, this is one of the most important pieces of real estate in Jacksonville. Its future is of interest to so many people. And what about the timing of this with Lenny Curry and Tony Slaman publicly throwing their arms around each other a few weeks before the election?
Yeah, you know, I think earlier last week we wrote a story about how the other landing trial was, you know, this other landing dispute over this parking lot was going to a trial, and that, you know, that thing was still going on. You look, anything that happens between qualifying and the election is a political move. I know that these sides have been negotiating for months to try to get a settlement, and it was going to happen at some point, but it is hard for a lot of people to sit there and say that this was not politically motivated. Whether or not it's a good move for the city or not to get a deal done, just because it's happening in February, a month out before an election, absolutely, it's going to be a political move.
Okay, and Claire Goforth, what about the pushback coming from average citizens saying, we haven't had the chance to weigh in on this. We also don't like the Hart Bridge ramps coming down without our input. We don't like all of these demolitions.
Yeah, I mean, there's two ways to look at it. We don't like having all these abandoned buildings around downtown. And with JEA looking to move their headquarters, we're probably going to have another one unless they do something with that. But then on the other hand, there's the preservation aspect. I mean, look at what they did with Jesse Ball DuPont Center. They remodeled that. They restored it to its original glory. Was it the old library? Is that right? And it's a beautiful facility now. I mean, there are opportunities there. But when I think about this landing issue, I think $15 million goes a long way to heal wounds. And then the other, I think, how much money have we spent negotiating, litigating, and now we're going to just stroke a $15 million check plus. And then meanwhile, we haven't fixed the docks in front of the landing since which hurricane was that? If we have $15 million, didn't we have whatever it cost to fix those docks so people can bring their boats back to the landing?
And what about the subtext to this too, David Bauerlein, that critics of this move have see the hand of Shad Khan in all of this, that this clears the way for Lot J and the area that he's developing around the stadium to really become the focal point downtown, not the Jacksonville Landing. Not that the Jacksonville Landing really was the focal point, but it's supposed to be.
Right. So right now, Florida, Georgia, the big celebrations are at the Jacksonville Landing. The idea would be that Florida, Georgia in the future, the big celebrations would be Lot J, where you'd have the amphitheater, maybe this entertainment complex. That would be the place where people gather. I don't know how much to read into Shad Khan being the mastermind behind this, because quite frankly, when Alvin Brown was mayor, he and Tony Slaman came to an agreement that it's best to tear down the landing and start fresh from scratch. That was long before Lot J and all these talk emerged from the Jaguar side of things. The real issue has always been, okay, tear it down. What happens next? Yeah. Still undetermined. Who is involved in it? Well, that's undetermined now, too, because for a while it was always the idea that Tony Slaman was going to be the long-term developer. He's now out of the picture, as Claire says, at a tidy sum. He bought it for $5 million. He's going to walk away with $15 million. So it's not a bad return.
That's right. Give us a call as we talk about the biggest stories of the week. Right now we're talking about the Jacksonville Landing. Call us up with your opinions and thoughts at 549-2937. Meanwhile, Charles Griggs, we're getting lots of emails about the landing. Here's one from our news partner, The Jackson. They point out to us, as they've summarized on their website, that demolition of a structurally sound building does not equal economic development. Point two, there are many options for adaptive reuse of this space in Norfolk, Baltimore, and Miami. festival marketplaces have been successfully updated with new tenant mixes. 3, demolishing the space will cause the downtown core to lose current businesses like Finn McCool's and Mavericks Live that are there now, and paying $18 million to demolish the landing only to then subsidize an equivalent project a mile away at Lot J is not a net gain for downtown or the taxpayers.
Yeah, I think, again, the key point from what we're obviously hearing from people in the community is that there's a difference between progress and being progressive. And the progress part is, you know, cutting a deal. The being progressive part is including people along the way and make sure that their thoughts are heard about what should be done next and how we can get the best use out of that particular area. It may not involve, I don't think anyone said that, but they suggested that that demolition probably would be the next step.
Yeah, I mean,
but you know, when you think about it, it almost seems like, given the current state of the property, demolition would be the next step. However, we haven't heard from all the voices out there to have ideas about how this could be done, what they're doing in other communities, and on and on and on.
Here's another email for you, David Cotton, from Bill. Total demolition as a first choice is irresponsible, as we've seen with the extraordinary number of vacant lots downtown. If you demo, they will not come.
Well, to that argument, let's just put it in perspective. The $1.5 million is going into the capital improvement budget. That is a 5-year, basically, plot of money that gets moved around for projects. Just because that money is there does not mean next year that that is going to happen. It's just we are earmarking this money in case a developer comes and they decide, hey, as part of a package, we want to demolish this. Doesn't mean the city's going to spend that money. I mean, that's what I think is missing with that argument there. A developer may come in and say, hey, we like the bones of this structure. We just need to open it up to Laura Street. You know, there's a lot of potential here. I also want to comment about this, you know, this discussion about tearing down historic buildings. Nobody in 10 years is going to remember the old city hall and the courthouse. They're not like these iconic structures. And looking out my window from the Daily Record, I now see the riverfront. And I think the people who own restaurants across the street there, I think they were excited to see these things go. It opens up for actually appropriate development on the riverfront. Now, should the city have spent $8 million doing that versus a developer holding those costs? Now, that's debatable.
Lots of calls now as we talk about the future of the Jacksonville Landing. Do you like the idea of demolishing it? Maybe putting a public park on the riverfront? Or do you have other thoughts? Give us a call, 549-2937. Eliza is downtown right now. Hi, Eliza. You're on the air. Good morning.
Hi. Good morning, Melissa. Thanks for taking my call. I hear everyone's comments. I'm just fast-forwarding to, let's say, the demolition takes place and it's cleared and a park is approved. I just wanted to mention the park's place on Main Street across from the library, and the continuing, seems like, higher numbers of homeless that are, you know, coming up to cars. I live in Springfield, coming up to cars, constantly stopping at red lights. It seems to be like another park space would be just another opportunity for even more homeless instead of us dealing with that. I know we're not talking about the homeless, but I do think that we should take that into consideration when thinking about a space that's not going to work. Thank you so much.
Thank you. That's Eliza in Springfield. Claire, what about the argument that if you create another open park space downtown, it will become a magnet for more homeless people rather than a sparkling jewel on the waterfront, I guess,
right. If we do not do something to get homeless people into long-term housing, which has proven to be the one solution to homelessness, then we will continue to have homeless people downtown occupying public spaces because these are human beings that have to exist somewhere.
Yeah, I think that's part of the deal when we're talking about a comprehensive plan to do something about this area and to redevelop the area. You can't just really look at it as a piece of property that you're going to develop into something along the riverfront. You have to take in consideration all of the things that go on that are part of that deal, because if it's going to be attractive, then it's going to draw people. And you're looking at the homeless population, which we haven't solved that problem here at all. I mean, we made some steps with the announcement with the day center just the last week. But at the same time, there are still draws here along the most attractive areas for people to go. You want it to be a place where everybody's going to feel safe. And in doing so, the folks who are participating in this process will have to take all of those things in consideration.
Rick in St. Augustine. Hey, Rick, good morning to you. Happy Friday.
Yes, good morning, Mrs. Melissa. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. Thanks. Go ahead.
Yes, ma'am. I was just listening to the comment about the Jacksonville landing, and I was just thinking, my comment is, those that are working at the landing, like the Hooters and things of that, you know, employees, how are they feeling this morning when they hear this on the radio that the landing could be, you know, getting ready to be demolished? These are people that won't have jobs, and that would be my comment.
Yeah, thanks, Rick, for that. Not a huge number of jobs, David Bauerlein, but some.
That's right, and there's really no firm timeline for when they would have to, when they would effectively lose their jobs in terms of being moved out. So there's a lot up in the air, and certainly, yeah, you would probably have to wonder what the next year is going to hold if you're right now getting a paycheck from a store or restaurant at the landing.
Here's a tweet from Steven. I'm going to guess what they'll do with the landing. A few trees, a Chick-fil-A, and a Hobby Lobby. Remember, Chick-fil-A is closed on Sundays, and that will allow for Jaguars pregame festivities. A little snark on Twitter this morning.
Hey, Chick-fil-A, I'll take that.
Okay, Brad is in Bartram. Hi, Brad. What are your thoughts? Good morning.
Hi there. I have a friend who recently moved to Memphis, Tennessee, and she got an internship at St. Jude's Hospital, and she lives in a repurposed Sears factory that's completely redone to accommodate even the children of St. Jude's, doctors, volunteers, etc. I don't see why not that there are either investors looking at the landing for some kind of potential opportunity to boost up the employee number or the preventative care aspect or even the Cancer Center in Jacksonville. That area can be repurposed for good, and I don't see why there aren't more people calling in asking about how we could regenerate that area to be repurposed into some kind of mode of living for even the homeless or some kind of people downtown. So yeah, that's my comment. It could definitely be recycled somehow.
Thanks, Brad. And that's the argument preservationists are making, and I think you'll hear them make some noise in the coming days. There's already a petition drive that's been set up, arguing, making those kinds of arguments.
Well, so. And I hope they do, because they need to be part of this discussion. I mean, while again, I struggle to see the significance of keeping this current structure intact as it is, I can definitely see how repurposing this into something that could flourish would be beneficial. I mean, we've got another project just near here on the other side of the stadium that is going to be turned into lofts. It's a big warehouse building, that type of thing. So that is happening in Jacksonville, but yeah.
Okay. And if you're just tuning in, it's our Friday Media Roundtable with David Bauerlein, David Cotton, Claire Goforth, Charles Griggs, and myself as we talk about the top stories of the week. Right now, we're going to pivot just a bit and talk about another headline that caught our eye this week. Jacksonville Mayor Lenny Curry has decided to push ahead with a program called Cure Violence. This is an innovative program that really got its start in Chicago some years ago, another city, of course, with a big issue with gun violence. Now, the managers with Cure Violence met earlier this week with the mayor, the sheriff, and the state attorney. The way this works is caseworkers go into neighborhoods and try to stop violence by treating it as a public health problem. They use people who've been incarcerated to identify young men at risk for being shooting victims or perpetrators. Team members also go to hospitals to speak with people who've been injured and families of those killed in homicides. This is a neighborhood approach, a public health approach to homicides and gun violence. And according to Cure Violence research, some target neighborhoods have seen a 70% reduction in shootings with this approach. Mayor Curry says he's willing to give Cure Violence a try in Jacksonville. So right now, here's our question to callers. What do you think about a new approach to solving or reducing our status as Jacksonville's or as Florida's murder capital by treating our murder rate and gun violence as a public health issue? Give us a call with your thoughts and comments about Cure Violence. Charles Griggs, what about Cure Violence?
So this is Cure Violence is something I'm very familiar with. As a former Department of Health employee, treating violence as a public health issue is something that we champion. I can remember as far back as I started there, maybe 2006, 2007, trying to pull together data and showing stakeholders and elected officials that this is the approach. However, acute violence is one component of what should be a comprehensive attempt at addressing violence in our community. The key part about cure violence is that you're going to be hiring, paying people in the community who are convicted felons who know the community better than anyone else. That means that the traditional law enforcement model are going to have to separate themselves a little bit from the way they normally do things. They're going to have to trust, you know, convicted felons and trust the way they do business with potential, you know, people in the community and those who are potentially going to offend in some type of manner. And that is really where the rubber meets the road. And that's, I think, the training on both sides is going to have to be comprehensive. And it's something that's really going to be a paradigm shift a lot for JSO, perhaps.
All right. David Bauerlein, can our criminal justice apparatus in Northeast Florida do a real paradigm shift and embrace this new way of keeping the peace and improving public safety in Duval?
At this point, it seems that could happen. State Attorney Melissa Nelson is the one who proposed this idea. And it also was supported by the sheriff. So right off the bat, it's got support across the board. I would think that from the sheriff's office perspective, they would be as happy as anybody to see this succeed. So much of the violence is the retaliatory violence. Having somebody who can intervene, talk to people, prevent that from one killing begetting another killing, one shooting begetting another shooting, is something that would be very effective. It seems to be a program that's been reviewed a lot by third parties, and it shows it works.
Many people will tell you that there are folks in the community already doing this work, and they're just not being paid to do it. Mm. And so, you know, with a strategic sort of effort in place and compensation, you're raising the potential for having better results. The fact is, you're going to have to measure things and see how well it works. But those people, you know, people in the community know who are the ones who are going to be most likely to offend if they haven't done so already, and intervene in a way that they can keep them from, you know, harming themselves or someone else.
Claire, this is a non-policing approach. This is a public health approach, treating murder and violence as a public health crisis.
It's a great idea. And as Charles points out, it's not a new idea, which makes me think maybe we should have city elections every 3 months or so, because we get such great things. We're getting the Homeless Day Resource Center back. We've got the landing deal worked out. Now it's cure violence. I mean, are we looking at a person in Lenny Curry who is running the Rick Scott model, where you're an election season moderate, and then after the election, you go back to being a hardliner?
Well, I mean, 62% of the people who responded to the UNF poll recently said crime was the number one issue in this city. Mm-hmm. I think they're looking at their internal polling as well and seeing that this is still something that bothers most people in Jacksonville.
But it was an issue 3.5 years ago.
It
three and a half
was.
Years ago, the solution was more cops. And now people are saying, well, maybe more cops really isn't the answer. So we're pivoting. And I think that is smart. I just wonder about the motivation and how long this is going to last after the election.
Well, cure violence, I think there's a commitment that the city would have to make for 3 years, I believe. Cure violence is not going to come in and just have it be where the city comes back and says months or a year later, nah, we're not interested anymore. They have to be all in on it. Yeah. So I think cure violence will be there. What other programs are there out there? I think that's a really interesting point in terms of what's next. Is there more to be done, like Charles is saying?
Yeah, the cure violence piece is part of the intervention piece. And so the prevention piece is really way out front down the road that needs to be invested in. And we need to look at more approaches for that. But this is one leg of the three-legged stool that needs to be addressed. And this is probably a proper approach to do so, empowering people in their own communities to do something when they know they can. And like I said before, there are many people already doing this work. They just aren't being compensated to do it by the city.
And a few pastors in the city have come forward too and this week and said, look, we've been asking the city to do this for years. So they see a little irony, I guess, in the embracing of this in a politically advantageous moment. But this is something that activists and pastors have been calling for, right?
And rightly so, because at some point, like Claire mentioned, we hired police officers, and we still haven't seen a difference. We haven't really made a difference in what we're getting. So, you know, try something different. You know, let's go to the community and ask what they would like to see, and maybe perhaps implement some of the programs and plans that some of the people on the ground, some of the pastors and some of the other organizations have been doing over the years on a smaller scale, and try to scale it up. And I think, you know, this is how Cure Violence started. You know, people, you know, saying just talking to folks and getting their attention and encouraging them not to do things or encouraging them to put their lives on a better track. And when you invest in people, that's when you see the difference. And that's where, you know, folks in the community can see the difference when you're investing in people and saying, hey, this guy actually cares about me because he's taking the time to talk to me and help me understand where I may be going wrong.
And to invest in Cure Violence in Jacksonville, the estimated cost to start the program is about $400,000 for the first year. The funds would apparently come from local, state, federal grants. If funding is secured, Cure Violence says they will be up and running in Jacksonville in a matter of months. So what are your thoughts about Cure Violence? 549-2937. Lots of calls about this, too. William is in Murray Hill right now. Hi, William. Good morning.
Good morning, Ms. Melissa. I attended a meeting last night with Mr. Gundy about something like you guys are talking about. I don't know if that was the name of it, but the reason I was kind of held back from maybe joining it, it was like some of the guidelines, the criteria they was using or speaking about, it sort of felt like if you go out in the community as a volunteer and say there's some nefarious stuff going on in the neighborhood and you know, get privy word of it, it's sort of like you can be perceived as a snitch and get hurt, you know, in these communities. And that's what I just want to hope it works, but it just have different connotations to different people, man.
Sure.
You guys have a good day.
No, thank you. And certainly police for years have struggled with that, with a no-snitch culture in parts of town. But I think why this is seen as a breakthrough is it's people that live in communities that have high rates of violence interrupting violence before it starts. It's not police coming in parachuting into a community and trying to stop a crime or react to it after it happens. People are interrupting violence in their own communities. They're being paid to do this. So it's a completely different thing. David Bauerlein.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, in some ways, let's say a murder happens or somebody is shot and taken to the hospital. Well, that person is going to have the police come ask them what happened. They're also going to have somebody from Cure Violence talking to them. And they're working two sides of the same approach. I mean, obviously, the police are investigating what happened and they want to find the person who did the shooting and bring that person to justice. Cure Violence is there to talk to the person who was shot and help them get to a place where they don't feel a need for revenge, right? And that's the interruption part. It's stopping that chain of violence that just seems to be a root cause of a lot of what we see in terms of all the murders that happen in the city.
Linda is in Deerwood. Hi, Linda. What are your thoughts? Good morning.
Good morning. I think that what we are seeing, every discussion we've had this morning have been about response by the mayor to issues that have been going on for all of his tenure. And maybe we should also give credit to Anna Broche, who is far down in the polls, but maybe he sees her obviously as a credible candidate and wants to address the landing, the crime problem, which is the main issue, with him actually listening, opening the day center that was closed when he first came in. Amazing how revelatory these issues are. So thank you, Anna Broche, whether you win or not. The city is winning based on you getting in the election. Thank you.
Okay, what about that?
I was saying. You know, we're seeing a bit of a shift in policy from the Curry administration with an election looming. I don't think that's unique to politicians. And I do believe the mayor has done things in his tenure to try to address violence. I think those things have been focused on the policing side. And unfortunately, the policing side can exacerbate these issues, because when we're policing and arresting and getting people on the path to incarceration, then we're taking them out of their homes and out of their families, and we're taking away these potentially positive influences they could have been had they not gotten to the system at very young ages.
Okay, here's a tweet from Glenn. I used to live in a problem neighborhood in Seattle. The city placed services throughout the community: police storefront, employment training, job searching, a community engagement staff. It is not cops or health. It is commitment to the people through services. You know, the only place I would think of that's similar to that in Jacksonville is the Newtown Success Zone, which is just northwest of downtown. And it has that sort of cradle to college wraparound city services model to try to lift up an entire neighborhood, the neighborhood around Edward Waters College. And it's modeled on the Harlem Children's Zone in New York, which has had success. But Newtown is a small little place, one little neighborhood, trying to kind of replicate that model. And so this gets back to another point that has been brought up in this show many times in recent months. As the city embraces Cure Violence, advocates for crime reduction have long been calling for a dedicated funding source in Jacksonville for a citywide initiative that could get at the long-term prevention and intervention strategies that are known to work,
which exist in other communities, and they fund these operations and these programs initiatives through those funding sources. And I would have to go back and disagree with the last message that you read there. At the end of it, health does matter. Every policy that is enacted, every economic development piece, every criminal justice piece, everything has an impact on a person's health outcome. And we're looking at what we're trying to do is improve life expectancy for people across our community and the quality of life. And so when we look at how we interrupt crime, we're actually trying to improve the person's life and their lifestyle and their opportunity to live a healthy life in our community. So we know that the life expectancy for African-American men is 15 years less than it is for white females in some areas of the town. So if we know that, then we have to look at those things that are causing those disparities. And in this case, it is, you know, intentional death. So we know that if that's a problem, then we have to do something about it. And these types of programs are just a portion of a one leg and a three-legged stool in terms of prevention, intervention, and make sure that those policies are there to help support communities that need to close those disparity gaps.
David Cotton.
Yeah, and I will say, you know, the issue with crime and violence also sort of, you know, it hinders what progress you can make with, say, a community redevelopment area, right? We've got one in Arlington. We've got the King Soutelle redevelopment area. And that is put in place there to keep tax money there to help spur economic development. But if there's violent crime all the time in these areas, then, you know, if I'm a business owner, what incentive do I have to be there if I fear safety? And these are some of the concerns that we hear from businesses.
Yeah. And as a community at large, when I travel,
yeah,
people are always saying, what's going on in Jacksonville with all the crime? We don't want to have that label. We have to do something about that. And investing in not only programs like this, but prevention programs, you know, downstream, you know, is to make sure that we can remove that label.
So where do you travel that you're hearing people say that?
I was Indianapolis, Huntsville, Atlanta.
So all over the country, people say that they've heard that we have an issue with, that's not a good thing.
That's not a good thing.
Yeah, definitely not what we want. And if you're just tuning in, it's our Friday Media Roundtable as we talk about the biggest headlines from the week. Here's another big one from the week. The Federal Energy Regulatory Commission denied JEA Thursday in the utility's attempt to get out of what critics have long called a boondoggle, the Project Vogtle nuclear deal. Now, JEA has been trying to separate itself from this nuclear expansion project in Georgia for years. It has been running billions of dollars over budget, and JEA wanted out. Well, the feds said, no, you can't get out of it. They first entered into this power purchase agreement in Georgia in 2008. JEA is having to absorb billions more in costs than they expected. That is even causing the city of Jacksonville's finances to be downgraded from credit giant Moody's. JEA CEO Aaron Zahn said in a statement this week that the vote clearly shows a preferred support, he said, for corporate interests over customer concerns. So JEA got a big fat no this week from the feds. And how does this affect the city of Jacksonville? Claire Goforth, I know, full disclosure, your husband is a JEA employee, but what are your thoughts?
Yeah, it seems to me like this is a case of holding people to the contract they agreed to. My understanding is that JEA entered into this contract eyes open and then later agreed to terms that were now considered unfavorable. You know, if you sign a deal for a house and then later the value goes way down and you're upside down in it, well, you're still going to have to pay for it. That's just the way contracts work.
Hmm. David Bauerlein.
Yeah, I think this ruling was no surprise. It was opposed on many different levels, industry, the federal government, other utilities. And like Claire says, the basic way that these large-scale, hugely expensive electric generating projects are built is by people agreeing up front that they're not going to have cold feet halfway into it and say, I'm bailing. Because if that was the case, these projects wouldn't get done because no investor is going to want to put up money to have a project where partners can just, you know, jump out when things start to become
difficult.
Yeah, right, exactly.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Charles Griggs.
Twice as much is a tough pill to swallow. And I can understand JEA wanting to get out of the deal, but the mistakes were made a long time ago, and it's too late to correct them. I think it looks like they're going to have to make the best of a bad situation going forward, because it looks like there's going to be no way out based upon the deal that they cut early on.
David Cotton, you know who's happy about this? Georgia.
Oh, I'm sure, yeah.
here's an article someone just tweeted me. Georgia regulators on February 19th approved another $526.4 million in expenditures by Georgia Power related to the long-delayed Vogtle nuclear power plant expansion.
Georgia is all in because, you know, this is a political football over there as well. They are certainly, I mean, you are so far into this deal. There's no way you're going to back out of this project when you're so over budget and already so invested. And the way they spin it in Georgia is that, you know, this is going to be this wildly successful expansion. And now we've got JEA down there in Jacksonville trying to thwart it and, you know, throw a wrench into everything.
Let me ask you, too, as a follow up, looking at the bigger picture of this, this is basically nuclear expansion for this region of the country, at the same time that progressives in Congress are calling for a Green New Deal, which would transition this country to a carbon-free, clean energy economy and not go heavy on nuclear power, get away from nuclear power. So what about that piece of this as well?
Right. The one reason the JEA got into this was because nuclear power is carbon-free. It was a way for them to meet these regulations they saw coming down the pipe that were going to really force them to move away from coal, dirty fuel like that. And nobody else is building nuclear plants. It seems like JEA is kind of out on the limb in that regard. So
yeah, it's the scare factor.
So, you know, and you're right. When people talk now about the Green New Deal, nuclear is not part of it. It's stuff like solar. It's those type of alternative energy forms, not nuclear power.
Yeah, when you talk to people in the utility industry, Claire, they will say, well, nuclear power, realistically, they see it as part of the mix. But people pushing for a Green New Deal are saying, no, we need to find a way to not use or really downscale the use of nuclear power as much as we possibly can.
Yeah, and I'm not sure why they think that. I mean, it's carbon neutral. It's already existing technology. With the solar energy, that technology is nowhere near where it needs to be for us to attain our energy needs. Think of the mass chaos that would result if we all switched over solar right now. We would have unreliable power. We would have plants that couldn't operate. But if we did nuclear, that would not even be an issue.
I think the perception is that nuclear isn't safe. I mean, just some of the past accidents that have happened, people perceive nuclear to be this disaster ready, unreliable source of energy. And that's why people don't really kind of think about it in that mix.
It's the fear factor, yeah. Definitely.
And let me read from a coalition of hundreds of environmental groups they sent a letter to Congress this month saying what they want included in the Green New Deal. They are calling for 100% renewable energy, and that is defined as excluding all combustion-based power generation, nuclear, biomass, large-scale hydro, and waste-to-energy tech. They're saying we don't want to shut down existing nuclear plants, but they are demanding that there be no new nuclear or hydro power. But as Claire pointed out, academic and energy analysts and the nuclear power enthusiasts say that's just not realistic. We can't decarbonize with purely renewable energy.
And correct me if I'm wrong, is Plant Vogtle the only nuclear power plant expansion left in the country?
Yes.
So, I mean, yeah, that's that. With Plant Vogtle, this is it. This is, at least for the foreseeable future, I don't see any communities stepping up to say, hey, we want to spend $30 billion on nuclear power plant expansions, especially as everybody's eyes are on Plant Vogtle and this, growing cost.
And my understanding of the Vogtle is there wasn't sufficient oversight in the project, and that was a huge part of the problem. There is precedent for cost overruns in nuclear projects. The last one, I believe, in the 1980s went over by some astronomical amount. I think that if we did these projects with a little bit more oversight, then we wouldn't be having these issues.
Let's go to Steve on the West Side. Hi, Steve. I think you want to talk about another story from the week. Go ahead. Good morning.
Well, earlier you were talking about how we could address crime. And one of the ways I'd like to see a crime addressed is to incentivize officers to actually live in and about these neighborhoods that are having the problem. I know when I have a heavy foot, and when I see a police officer, it certainly lightens up when I'm driving down the road.
Me too.
And if I was thinking I'm going to do something a little shady, and I saw a police officer, every time that thought hit my brain, kind of like Clorox, just washes it right out.
Funny.
I think
okay.
That would, it's something that you could do without spending a ton of money.
Okay, thanks. So rather than hiring Cure Violence violence interrupters to live and work in neighborhoods, pay police more to live in neighborhoods. I think JSO does that to a degree, yeah. But I'm not an expert on how they, and so certainly they're undercover officers, but what about his argument?
That's all a part of relationship building, right? And
yeah.
there are plenty of JSO officers who are from the community, who still live in the community. I don't think that really is a problem or a part of the issue. The JSO officers are great. There are plenty of people. I know plenty of officers who grew up in the neighborhood
that they
serve in.
And speaking of police, last but not least, it's our look at the strange, bizarre, and ridiculous from the week around the state. This one actually goes out of state. Luckily, never a shortage of material. It's your Friday only in Florida. And yes, this week only in Florida, we're taking a road trip thanks to a couple of bad boys from Florida. They were arrested in Ohio for packing the wrong kind of lunch. Nelson Lopez III and Nelson Lopez Jr. of Zephyr Hills were arrested up in Ohio after police found a large quantity of cocaine in their rented Ford F-150. However, much to the police's surprise, the illegal substance was stashed in Kraft Lunchables containers.
Lunch is what you snort of it.
They stumbled upon the stash after noticing that the Lopez Sr. and Jr. had Lunchables containers that seemed exceedingly heavy. Instead of lunch meat, crackers, and cheese and cookies, they found $84,000 worth of blow inside. So
that's a diet that works.
Thank you, Charles, Andrew, David, and Claire. Guys, thanks so much for spending most of the hour with us. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you, Melissa.
And up next, a live in studio preview of Douglas Anderson's Extravaganza. We'll be right back. Bad boys, what you gonna do? What you gonna do when they come for you?
Bad boys, what you gonna do? What you gonna do when they come for you? Wayne Hogan of the Terrell Hogan Law Firm.
I'm Wayne Hogan. You don't let employees drive drunk, but talking on the phone creates the same risk. Learn about distracted driving presentations for the workforce.
Learn more at waynehogan.law.
The Players' Championship moves to March. The drama unfolds on the Island Green March 12th through the 17th with the all-new Players' Welcome Experience, featuring the PGA Tour fan shop and a variety of local restaurants. Tickets and parking today at theplayers.com.
People in the U.S. have a history of dismissing racist, homophobic, or sexual violence. Recently, there have been calls to believe people who say they are victims. It appears Empire actor Jussie Smollett may have been taking advantage of that impulse.
It's not necessarily that you don't believe that this is the truth. You don't even want to see the truth.
This afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Today at 4 on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world.
I'm Ira Flatow. As a young graduate student, Priya Natarajan made a prediction about the behavior of black holes. Now, 20 years later, she's been proven right. We'll let her gloat and explain. We'll also talk about another prediction yet to come true, a storm so strong it could make a lake out of California's Central Valley. It's all on Science Friday from WNYC Studios.
Friday at 3 on 89.9 WJCT.
Rumor has it that Robert Mueller's big reveal on Russia is just days away. One former acting FBI director won't rule out that the president is a Russian asset. Donald Trump says it's all lies. And look who's back.
I am going to run for president. That's correct.
What's going to be different this time?
We're going to win.
The Friday News Roundup, next time on 1A. Today at 10 on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. Well, finally this hour, you don't want to miss Douglas Anderson School of the Arts 32nd Annual Extravaganza Showcase this weekend. It's a Broadway-style extravaganza of acting, musical performances, and much more. This is one of the most beloved events of the year on the arts and entertainment calendar. So we're pleased to welcome DA's own Scott Renaud. Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa. How are you?
And Rhea Eilani, a senior musical theater major at Douglas Anderson. Good morning to you.
Hi.
And in a moment, we'll hear Rhea perform. But Scott, let's talk about the fact that Extravaganza now is going into its 32nd year in Jacksonville. That is really amazing.
Isn't it something? You know, when you think back, it was kind of controversial when they started Douglas Anderson School of the Arts because very few cities in the country had a school just for kids who were passionate about the visual and performing arts. So kudos to our mayor and the city council and the Duval County Public Schools for giving it a chance. And after about a year and a half that the school had been in operation, our principal and then Ace Martin, who's our music director, thought, you know, we need to demonstrate to the residents of Jacksonville what these kids are able to accomplish because they're going to DA. And so they started the showcase. And the first year, it was called A Gift to Jacksonville. In fact, we actually have the poster up on the wall. And instead of saying extravaganza, it says A Gift to Jacksonville. And it was a showcase to show the residents what these kids can accomplish. And it's pretty phenomenal.
Well, at this performance, we'll have singing, acting, orchestra, visual arts, and more, even more than that, I think.
Yeah,
right?
See, that's
a little bit
of
everything.
That's what I love about extravaganza. Now, I happen to live down in St. John's County, so it's difficult for me to always get up for the symphony or a musical here in town. But if I come to extravaganza, it's like you say, it's a celebration of the arts. And so you're going to see ballet, you're going to see our strings orchestra, our wind symphony, and musical theater that you'll hear a little bit in a few seconds. So it's really an opportunity to, in one evening, experience quite a variety of the arts.
Our older daughter, full disclosure, is a student at DA. So I do say this with some bias when I say that I think people are continually amazed at how good these kids are.
Well,
they are just amazingly good,
isn't it? Because they're going to go on to the top universities and conservatories in the country. Some will go directly to New York and Los Angeles and work professionally. But I was talking with Rhea earlier, and she said, yes, DA absolutely prepares us for a future in the arts.
All right, Rhea, you are a senior musical theater major. Tell me about your program of study at DA.
Well, at DA, we are placed in a class with, I have about 14 other kids in my class, I think. And I have 5 arts classes and 3 academic classes. And most of my day is performing and dancing and singing. And I really have teachers that want to see me succeed and help me with the college process and also face rejection.
Do you know where you want to go to college and what you want to do after school, after you graduate?
Oh, I plan to get a BFA in musical theater, and I'm auditioning for colleges right now. I've gotten into a few, and I've gotten rejected from a few, but...
What are your top choices? Where do you want to go?
My top choice is University of Michigan.
Okay. And do you want to be a Broadway performer once you get done with school?
Yes, that's...
That's the goal?
That's the goal.
Okay, well, I'm sure you'll do beautifully. Right now, we have a preview of Extravaganza. You're singing Waiting for Life from the Broadway show Once on This Island, a cappella. Here she is, Rhea Ailani.
Oh, gods, please be there. Don't you remember your little Timon from the trees? Wake up, look down, hear my prayers. Don't single me out and then forget me. Oh gods, let me fly. Send me to places where no one before me has been. You spare my life, show me why. You get me to rise like a fish to the bait, then tell me to wait. Well, I'm waiting, waiting for life to begin. Waiting for life to begin.
All right.
Tremendous.
Beautiful.
Thank you.
Thank you. And so that is just a short snippet of what you'll be doing Saturday night.
Yep.
On stage at Douglas Anderson's Extravaganza. Scott Renaud, just a few tickets left, right?
Yes, it's at the Moran Theater, and there are a few tickets left. You can check Ticketmaster.com, or if you come to the theater, the art gallery starts at 6:30. The show in the theater starts at 7:30. There will be tickets available Saturday night.
Okay, so get your tickets now, and kudos, Rhea. Best of luck in college. Scott Renaud, thanks for everything you do. Educating these talented youngsters at Douglas Anderson. Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
All right, that's our show. Our producer is Heather Schatz. Michelle Corum is our director. And if you have any feedback, always send it to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Also, don't miss our statewide show, The Florida Roundup, coming up today at noon, where we round up the biggest stories from across the week. All around the state. I'm Melissa Ross. Thanks for listening. We'll be right back here again at 9 a.m. Monday. Have a great weekend.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.